Hello and welcome to another episode of High Low with Imrata. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. If you're not, I just want to run through. Tuesdays, we have our feature-length interview with culturally relevant guests like Taylor Lorenz, Esther Perel, Victoria Monet, Flo Millie. On Thursdays, we do an Imrata Asks, where I do a deep dive in onto a topic that's been on my mind or could be related to current events or a book or a recent interview. And also every Thursday, we drop an exclusive subscriber-only talkback episode where I play your voice notes and respond to your comments. If you want to hear what you're missing, use the free trial feature on Apple Podcasts to check it out. I really love that episode. All right, this week we're doing one related to the news. We're going to be talking about the intersection of the legal world and celebrity. If you follow entertainment or pop culture news, which everyone and their mother does now, there have been quite a few prominent cases and legal developments over the past few months as they pertain to very big stars. A couple examples, Tory Lanez, Megan Thee Stallion shooting trial, the actor Danny Masterson's recent convictions for his sexual assault. But obviously, in the past year, there's been Johnny Depp versus Amber Heard trial, obviously got a lot of coverage, and plenty of other important but lesser known legal battles that play out on a daily basis. Megan Cunniff, a legal affairs reporter, played a crucial role in providing accurate information during the high-profile trial of Tory Lanez, who was charged with shooting Megan Thee Stallion and sentenced to 10 years. Amidst widespread online speculation and a lot of misinformation, Cunniff earned the nickname Meg the Reporter as she became a trusted source of information, especially among Megan Thee Stallion's fan base, the Hotties. She's also been verbally attacked for her reporting, both online and even in the courtroom. And Tory Lanez himself has had some pretty terrible things to say about her. We are going to have her on today to discuss a lot of things that have come up, actually, in the Taylor Lorenz interview about traditional media versus all the media we get from different sources online, about misogyny and celebrities and privacy with these cases, so much more. After this break, we will be back with Megan Cunniff.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome back to High Low with Imrata. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, let's just jump right in if that's okay with you.
Sure.
All right, well, first off, I just wanted to kind of introduce you to our listeners. Can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm Megan Cunniff, and I am a legal affairs journalist in Southern California. I cover trials in Orange County in LA, a lot of celebrity cases, and then some federal public corruption cases thrown in.
I read that you come from a family of legal scholars and that you actually remember your dad discussing the O.J. Simpson trial during dinners. Have you always known what you wanted to do?
I've always been interested in the law, and I've always been geared toward journalism, for sure. It was always between being a lawyer and being a journalist, and journalist was always first on the list. So being able to combine the law and journalism is really kind of a dream come true.
I wanted to ask you about the ethos around what you do. I'm curious about your personal ethos and why you think it's so important for folks to have access to the information you provide.
Right. I think everyone has an opinion these days, and we're in the era of social media commentary and everyone wanting to weigh in on the gossip. And I think if you have facts, you can really stand out, and you can stand out from the crowd and really make a difference in letting people know what's actually going on and being factual in your reporting and really understanding the court system and letting people know what's going on and what's really a powerful public system that doesn't get a lot of scrutiny.
Absolutely. a lot of people first became familiar with you and your name during your reporting of the Tory Lanez trial over shooting, his shooting of Megan Thee Stallion. I wanted to get into some of the specifics later, but more broadly, I'm just curious about what your experience was like covering this case as an independent reporter. I assume you have a lot of choice in which stories and legal matters you choose to cover.
Absolutely. It was definitely an experience. And really, it's the case that really spurred me to independence, because I was covering the trial when I was at Law and Crime News initially. I was up in L.A. Superior Court covering Harvey Weinstein's trial. Danny Masterson, that 70s show actor, had his trial around the same time. So it made sense just to transition to this other celebrity trial for Law and Crime News. But I got so much attention over it, and there was so much interest in the ins and outs of the case, that I felt that to really be able to cover all that and to give the information and the stories over the post-trial stuff that we needed, that readers were interested in, the best way to do that was to go independent and start publishing on my own Substack and try to retain my audience that way. So it was really what kind of pushed me to go independent, just because I saw what a huge interest there was in the case and just the lack of capacity at like traditional organizations to cover it the way that people were wanting it to be covered.
Wow, I didn't realize that was why you went independent. That's very interesting. During the Tory Lanez and Megan Thee Stallion case, you said the first big tweet that I saw was that somebody had taken my picture and they said, "It's unfortunate that a white woman with a bob is our only source for accurate information." What was your reaction to seeing that for the first time?
I remember just being taken aback at how many likes it had. It had like 11,000 likes or something, and I was just kind of blown away by those numbers. But it struck me how personal this was for people. And of course, you kind of focus on the bob comment. And one of my friends was like, "Are they making fun of your hair?" And I said, "No, I don't think they are. Like, I don't think I should take this as any kind of personal attack against me. It's just a broader point about black representation in the media that, you know, I shouldn't take personally. If anything, they're complimenting me in a way." It just showed what a personal case this was for people and how much interest there was, and then how symbolic it was about black representation in media and the way mainstream media covers cases that are important to non-white communities.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, this case is even still, I mean, Drake said something the other night about Meg Thee Stallion at his concert. It still seems to sort of be this really divisive case. And I know you quickly kind of seem to earn the respect and trust of a lot of Meg's fans and supporters. But I also imagine it was really difficult to deal with the other side of Tory's fandom. What has it been like?
What was so interesting was that it really came up after the trial. During the trial, one, I was so busy covering the trial that I wasn't really paying attention to all the chatter. But everyone on both sides was really tuned into me for information. And then it was after he got convicted and the reality kind of set in for his fans that he was in jail and this was it, that they really started scrutinizing me and attacking me. And they seemed to think that they could wage some kind of public relations campaign in which would help his chances for a motion for new trial. I'm just not quite sure what it was, but it really formed in the months after the trial. And it was just surprising because it was so personal and vicious, but then it also just seemed pointless. I mean, it was just chatter on the internet that you can block people over. I mean, the idea that I was actually being harassed when I could just block them, I mean, it just seemed kind of silly. And in the end, he didn't get a new trial and he got sentenced to 10 years in prison. So I'm not really sure what they were trying to accomplish.
But you also had to deal with some of that from Tory and his defense attorney directly, right? They said some pretty terrible things about you.
Yes, there was a moment in the summer where I covered a lawyer who was trying to come in on Tory's case, and she'd met with him in jail, and she did an interview with me. And I saw it as being a frustration on their part with a lack of control of the message. And I've heard that from other people who've followed this case for so long, that the way the hip-hop blogs work and the news cycle in the hip-hop industry works is that it's pretty easy to control the news cycle and feed information these blogs. So Tory Lanez was so used to doing that that then a journalist came in who he didn't really have any control over. And I'm covering something in the summer involving a lawyer that they just didn't like the news. So Jose Baez, the prominent lawyer in Florida, who I think people might know from the Casey Anthony case all those years ago, he was representing Tory. And he went on his Instagram story. And actually, first of all, Tory Lanez's team went on Tory's Instagram story and said, with all due respect, you know, don't believe anything Megan Cunniff says. She's very biased against Tory and has an agenda. So all it really did was raise my profile quite a bit because he has so many followers. And I remember my website traffic just spiking that day because people were Googling me. You know, they didn't know. But I really seem to have gotten under their skin in some way.
I mean, I think this all speaks to the importance of what you do, because now there is obviously so many non-traditional media sources and ways people get their information, and people use their platforms to sort of try to sway people. It is kind of back to the point you made about the importance of what you do, really clear when you see the reaction that Tory and his defense tried to kind of use, you know, their his following to sway the court system.
Yeah, they definitely did. There, what really was highlighted in this case was the huge disconnect between, you know, popular opinion on the internet, the Instagram comment section, and then what actually happens in the courtroom. Because for me, going into the case, not being familiar with any of the backstory on it, I just from immediately didn't think it looked good for Tory. I mean, I was like, this is a pretty, seems like it's going to be a pretty slam dunk conviction. I mean, it's hard to get an acquittal in a case like that. And this just seemed like a silly defense. And he just seemed completely cooked from the opening statement for me. And that was me going into it completely cold, not even knowing who he was. I'd heard of her before, but I actually hadn't even heard that she'd been shot before. So it was really surprising to me that he just thought he'd be acquitted, that they thought that that could actually happen. I mean, the chances of that actually happening in the court system are like slim to none, but you know, it could. So I guess he was just really gassed up on that.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about his sentence and how you feel it stacks up, and also kind of about his general conduct and behavior throughout the trial and how it may have influenced or not influenced the time that he did get.
Yeah, the judge did make it clear that the post-shooting behavior, and that's the album that he wrote, Daystar, that was released a few months after the shooting, that has lots of lyrics about the shooting, that the prosecutor actually quoted a few times during the sentencing hearing, all the social media posts, and then his court order violations. There was a protective order in place against Megan. He wasn't supposed to come within 100 feet of her, and he'd actually gone to the Rolling Loud Music Festival in Miami with DaBaby and gotten up on stage when she was performing at the same show, and it was a breach of the protective order violation. And that led to a misconduct finding by the judge, or that he'd violated a pretrial order. So all of those missteps after the shooting definitely contributed to his sentencing. The judge said he saw that behavior as a major aggravating circumstance in the sentence. So it's possible that he could have gotten a few years less if he hadn't had that conduct.
Yeah, there's still a lot of talk of like, free him, he's innocent. Aiden Ross recently popped up on Megan's TikTok comments and wrote, free Tory, and he said there's no evidence. Can you just sort of, you know, fact check that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of evidence against him. There was at least 47 pieces of evidence entered on his side, or on prosecutor's side of the case. There's the jail phone calls are bad for him. The one phone call that he made to Kelsey Harris, who's Megan's friend, where he's apologetic. He doesn't actually apologize for the shooting. But when you listen to the phone call, the prosecutor said there's just nothing else it seems like he could be talking about there. The fact that the gun was found at his feet, he was identified by Sean Kelly, who was a neighbor, who said that he thought that the women were fighting initially, and that he thought the flashes, aka the gunshots, started with one of the women. But then he unequivocally identified Tory as the shooter and said Tory was firing everywhere and really agitated. So that was really bad for him. And I mean, there's just a culmination of evidence here that contributes to that. And I think that kind of messaging against Megan is something that she might just have to, you know, we might be enduring that for a long time, because I don't feel like these people are open to facts. I don't feel like we could sit them down and go through the evidence and go through the trial with them and have them understand, because in the end, this information is all out somewhere. But just the misogyny that she's always faced, the idea that that's just going to completely go away, I think it's just kind of a sad commentary on some of those people that they choose to do that.
I want to talk a little bit more about that with you in a second. But first, I wanted to talk about the Iggy Azalea letter that she wrote on behalf of Tory Lanez, especially in the wake of the Danny Masterson, Ashton Kutcher, and Mila Kunis letter to the judge also getting leaked, and, you know, sort of the backlash they've received. We will be back with more right after this break.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
Welcome back to High Low with Emrata. I wanted to kind of get you just talking about how common it is for these sort of letters to be submitted and, you know, how often are they leaked? It seemed like everyone was very surprised, Iggy and Ashton and Mila, that they got out. I don't know that they would have written these letters had they known they were going to be public. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, they're so common in the court system. And I'm actually working on an article right now about that, just how these types of letters get filed really in every kind of case. And it's so common to hear from family members and friends about background of the criminal defendant, and whether there are calls for leniency or not is sometimes up in the air. But the letters are always public. And Iggy Azalea made clear, she said in her tweet that she was told that the letter wouldn't be made public, that it was for the judge's eyes only. And Ashton Kutcher almost said that in his video, but didn't quite. He just said that it was for the judge. Especially Danny Masterson's lawyers are really experienced. So I would be surprised if they had told Ashton that only the judge would see it, because these are so traditionally public records. In the federal court system, we could all just go online right now to a high-profile case and a sentencing and pull up the sentencing letters. Like when Elizabeth Holmes, America's favorite fraudster, got sentenced in the Theranos scandal, she had a ton of letters and from some pretty prominent people. Cory Booker, the senator, actually wrote her a letter. So of course, when that was docketed, everybody was able to get it instantly, and it was a story. It's harder to get those documents in LA Superior Court because they're not just online. You can't just log in and download it, but they're still public records. So, and the judge in Lanez's case made clear that they would be put on the public record, and then the judge in Masterson's case too. So I think Tory Lanez's lawyers, Jose Baez not being from California and Matthew Barhoma not having that much experience with criminal sentencings in trial court, I think they just didn't know and must have just told Iggy Azalea wrong. But I would just be so surprised if Danny Masterson's lawyers had told Ashton that his letter wouldn't be out, because it's just, it's such a classic public record. And to me, it's kind of offensive and scary for the court system and democracy and public society that celebrities think that they can write letters to judges advocating for lenient criminal sentences in big public cases, and that nobody will ever know. That the judge will just like take all these letters in secret, and that the judge could be influenced by this and not tell the public about it. It seems completely inappropriate to me that anybody would even be okay with that.
Yeah, it's also bizarre. I mean, as somebody who's a public figure, like I'm very used to everything getting leaked. So I was very shocked that these people had expected that these would be private. And also just that their behavior privately and public would potentially be different is also alarming. I wanted to talk to you about the misogyny of all of this. I mean, you mentioned you covered the Danny Masterson case. We've talked about it a couple of times in regarding the letters and everything else, but also obviously the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp trial, and then even just the own the you know attacks that you faced. I know we could talk about this for hours, but I'm just kind of interested to hear your notes on how you think women are treated specifically in the legal system, but also in the media, and how you think things would have maybe been different for you if you had been a man covering these high profile cases.
The legal system has obviously so much misogyny. I mean, if you look at big law firms and their partner counts, it's mostly men. The number of female judges, of course, is pales in comparison to the number of male judges. But that being said, my years in legal journalism, like working for the Los Angeles Daily Journal and then ALM, I really didn't feel like I was treated with outright disrespect from the lawyers that I covered and the judges that I met with. I to the contrary, I felt, if anything, that these people had more respect for me and treated me less condescendingly than I would get when I worked at like the Orange County Register and was covering the Board of Supervisors or county government. And it's like some public relations person who's like, oh, is this some story you're working on, hon? You know, something like that. The lawyers, if you call lawyers and you can show that you actually do know about their case and you've been sitting in the trial and you understand the trial, you can earn their respect that way. So I went into the mainstream law crime coverage coming from that background. And so I was really taken aback by like the immaturity level and some of the insults that were being flown around on Twitter. And part of that is I think just Twitter has changed so much in the last few years, but it was really a push to focus on your appearance. I mean, I talked about this with another neighbor woman journalist who has a big audience, and they always go for your appearance. I mean, it's always that you're ugly or some kind of commentary about your home life and your husband or something. I mean, it's very, very focused on that.
And what about in the actual courtroom with Meg Thee Stallion and what she experienced?
Oh, and I think it was such a microcosm of like the bigger internet attack and the outrage that she had. I mean, she had endured so much for so long. But then when she goes into the courtroom, she had a very like commanding presence in the courtroom. And I still have the video of her walking into the courthouse and just kind of the big scene and the kind of the almost parting of the waters that happened before for her. So she definitely had a big presence in the courtroom that, you know, it's not like anyone was shouting insults at her when she was up on the witness stand. You know, it was almost symbolic of how different it is and how the internet world and in the trash talking that goes on there is just not the same as the real world, and how the real world and the people who run it, you know, maybe don't take that stuff very seriously.
Right. Like they wouldn't say it to your face.
Yes.
Do you think that there, I mean, you've been covering this kind of stuff for a while. Do you think that there, because of this culture of kind of hate on the internet, misogyny on the internet, what do you think kind of we can do to change the culture around misogyny and sexism, both in real life and online?
I think the big thing is to push back and speak out about it, because you want to ignore it and you want to not give it the attention that it deserves. But I think society also needs to be a little more vocal or a little more disowning of that behavior and to speak out against that. But, you know, I also think I think that people do. And I think the idea that I covered a hip hop case involving a rapper who shot another rapper. And if you just listen to some of Tory Lanez's lyrics, I mean, the idea that some of his fans were being misogynistic to me online, it's like, oh, no, really? I mean, it's like, I don't think we're onto some big revelation here that the hip hop industry treats women like trash. It's just I mean, I should be fortunate that I didn't have it on the same level as Megan Thee Stallion. And you'd like to think that this would be some kind of reckoning for the hip hop industry and everything that happened and the way she was treated. But, you know, like you said, there's people right now currently flicking Megan crap on social media. And what kind of backlash are they actually facing for this? Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem like much.
Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show and appreciate what you do as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. I love that episode. I feel Megan had so much to say, and I just think what she's doing is really important work. And I really thought the stuff she had to say about the letters that were sent to the judge was very interesting. I'm excited to read her piece about that because I think it's quite crazy that we had both Iggy Azalea and Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis letters like that leak within weeks of each other. And I'm confused because I have to say, as somebody who's been in the public eye and dealt with many legal cases, sort of everything you submit to the court is public record. And everybody seemed or at least acted surprised. And I don't know if people around them are not smart enough to tell them to not do that or if they're not. I don't know. But that's just really interesting to me. Thank you so much for listening. Again, I do a third episode every week. That's Talk Back. That's the one where I play your voice notes. I feel like I'm going to get a lot of submissions because this has continued to be such a controversial case. So please go to hilo.fm or call in the hotline 42-HILO-4. If you're listening on Spotify, use the Q&A feature on the app or on YouTube. You can always comment. But again, we prefer the voice notes. So thank you so much for listening, and we will be back next week.
High Low with Imrata is a Sony Music Entertainment and Bitch Era Media production. Our executive producers are me, Emily Ratajkowski, Matt Raz, and Sarita Wesley. Our showrunner is Matt Raz. Our associate producer is Rachel Choder. Today's episode was engineered by Samantha Gatzik with original music by The Crystal Pharaoh.